It's not lost on me that the word matter can have multiple meanings. There's the one which is the overarching focus of this podcast, the one that's invoked when we say that something or someone matters, or when I ask, what really does matter and why? And then there's the meaning of the word that points to physical, tangible, measurable matter. Things, objects, the stuff that everything is made of, that we can see and smell and taste and touch and hear, the matter that gets converted into energy and beamed around by the transporter on the Starship Enterprise, the kind of matter which is somehow the same thing as energy, E equals MC squared and all that. Physical matter is, they tell us, composed of atoms, which, they tell us in turn, are mostly empty space between charged particles, electrons and protons and neutrons and such, that are zipping in orbits around each other, held in relationship to one another by basic forces like electrical charge and gravity. Now don't worry, as you've heard me say once or twice before, I'm not going to get all sciencey here. Where I'm really going with this is to wonder about whether and why and how matter matters. I'm Chris Johnson. Welcome to another episode of Pause, Purpose, Possibility. I'm titling this one, Living a Life That Matters, Part 2, From Star Stuff to Cow Pies in a Warm Summer Rain, for reasons you'll hear in just a second. As I just noted, this one explores ways in which our physical, material, embodied existence, from hard work and good food to skin color and mortality, can be part of what it means to live a life that matters. Thanks for being here. As inclined as I might be to habits of mind that are a little, or a lot, up and out there, a big picture ideas person, I am, as you know if you've been listening to other episodes along the way, still and always a farm kid, head in the clouds and feet on the ground. I love reflecting on the fact that we're all made of star stuff, composed of elements that were created in the furnace of some distant, long-vanished star and hurled unimaginable distances eventually to coalesce into our sun and the planets of our solar system, recycling again and again across the eons to become us. So that's a sample of the head in the clouds part. Whether relishing big ideas and big questions, or maybe just imagining that I'm Han Solo or Luke Skywalker. As for feet on the ground, in the summer, as a kid, my feet would often be bare as they took me here and there around the farm, up onto the roof of the machine shed, and, much to my mom's chagrin, out into the pasture to squish and squelch in the cow pies. Ooh, especially gratifying in a warm summer rain. All right, now, don't get me wrong. I don't want to paint a caricature of farm life. My family was not a destitute passel of hayseed yokels with hordes of raggedy children running amok, and my childhood wasn't something out of Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer. We were clean, respectably if modestly dressed, resourceful and responsible caretakers of our tidy, ordinary little farm. The land and the water, the animals, the buildings and equipment. We read a lot, enjoyed performing and listening to music, were active in 4-H and school and the little Lutheran church down the road. And we weren't afraid of nature. We quietly reveled in the simple beauty all around us. And we accepted that there was also decay and disease, suffering and death. The rhythms of the seasons were real and meaningful. The work was variously dirty, dusty, greasy, itchy, monotonous, smelly, bloody, muddy, painful, dangerous, soothing, exhilarating, sweaty, impossible, gratifying. For example, it's a gruelingly long, broiling hot, no breeze day of baling hay. Hard to know which is worse, to be out in the scorching sun, struggling to keep up with the relentless pace of the bales as they advance up the chute at the rear of the baler and hefting them one by one onto the growing stack on the rack, 4 and 5 and sometimes 6 levels tall, or stuck up in the dimly lit, airless, sweltering hay barn, barely able to breathe through the chaff and the choking dust of the bales as we race to get this load stacked into place before the next one comes. Steady, rhythmic, satisfying work, and itchy, stifling, grimy, dangerous work. Things break or jam or need to be greased or repaired. It's utterly exhausting and bursting with sensations and with significance. More on that in a sec. If there's time between the emptying and stacking of one load and the arrival of the next full one, we guzzle cup after cup, a chipped, white, slightly dented tin cup with a faded red rim, of pure, teeth-achingly cold well water pumped up from 200 or maybe even 300 feet deep in the earth. And when it's time for lunch or supper, we wash up as best we can under that same icy well water faucet, and then in to eat. Oh my gosh. Nothing satisfies like a meal that both tastes so good and provides fuel to sustain the work. Mom could work magic. Heaping bowls of stick-to-your-ribs rich scalloped potatoes with ham, or meatloaf and baked potatoes, or maybe tuna noodle hot dish. Jello with sliced bananas or fresh berries, carrot sticks, buttered corn or peas or green beans, thick bread or rolls with creamery butter and home-preserved jam, bottomless glasses of chilled milk, from the cows, of course, and a huge bowl of Schwann's vanilla ice cream with chocolate sauce or a hunk of apple crisp for dessert. So, I promised to say more about the hard work of farm life bursting with significance. It meant something. It mattered. It was in and shaped by nature. It was about caring for the earth and its creatures. Awe, wonder, gratitude, astonishment, love of beauty, the wisdom of the rhythms and the cycles and the seasons of life, the constant interplay of life and death, decay and growth, labor and rest, breathing in and breathing out. I learned on the farm many years before I actually saw it on a bumper sticker that, pardon me, Mom, shit happens, and how to live a life in spite of or because of that fact. Life on the farm, the hard work especially, taught valuable life lessons and shaped character. Stamina, resilience, patience, perseverance, ingenuity and inventiveness, commitment, humility, simplicity, teamwork, a sense of self-reliance inextricably woven with and tempered by a deeper awareness of the truth that we are all in this together. I don't think it's a tautology to say that hard work instilled in me a strong work ethic, a sense of responsibility and excellence that fed everything from good grades in school to being maybe over-involved in a whole bunch of other stuff. In my case, bands and choirs, theater and speech, 4-H and church, volunteering on political campaigns. Okay, I admit that last one was at least partly motivated by my having a bit of a crush on the daughter of the local county extension agent who ran for Congress early in my high school days. The hard work on the farm was about not just making a living or supporting a family, although it was certainly both those things. It was about growing a life, one of meaning and purpose, one that took the long view rather than being fixated on immediate gratification and acquisitiveness. To be honest, that early work ethic might also have partly sown the seeds in me of depression, workaholism, and burnout in later years. I think I fell under the spell of believing that my worth as a person was in proportion to my accomplishments, that the harder I worked, the more I achieved, the louder and more prolonged the applause, the more lovable I was. My sense of self became dependent upon my grades, awards, recognition, the admiration and affirmation of others. I think it's true that in a lot of ways I lived to make my parents proud. I could think of few things worse than disappointing them. Now, that wasn't their fault. They loved me deeply and unconditionally, and I craved it, was addicted to it, and somehow didn't acquire or grow into a capacity to value, trust, or love myself from within. I've recently heard it said that children breathe the air that their parents put out, just as humans breathe oxygen produced by trees. Even as adults, we continue to swim in the water that was our parents' sense of themselves. If that's the case, it goes a long way to helping me to understand why I have such a perpetual sense that I am not enough, because I think that maybe that's what they believed about themselves, at least sometimes. Mom especially. Her own struggles with depression, exacerbated by a range of chronic health issues, caused her to believe that she didn't matter, it seemed to me as a kid growing up. And like me, she seemed to derive her sense of self, at least during my childhood, from what she did, from her role as mother, which in turn fueled my need to please and make her proud. If she could believe that she was a good mom, that her kids were doing well, then, it seemed to me, she would be more apt to be able to accept herself. And yet, this was the mom who would softly, patiently sing me to sleep at night when I was a child. Naughty little bunny, nibbling apple trees, always takes a nibble, never saying please. Naughty little bunny, we don't really mind, for we know that winter food is very hard to find. Thanks for bearing with my singing voice. Or sometimes Mom would sing me to sleep with this one, which was and still remains my favorite. It has a slow, soothing, minor key, atmospheric feeling to it. When she'd sing, I could so vividly picture soft moonlight filtering through the trees in a hushed, peaceful glade deep in an ancient forest, where all is safe and at rest. In a mossy linden cradle, high up in the swaying trees, sleeps a lovely, beautiful baby, gently rocked by every breeze. That is the song I sang to her over and over again across the days and nights of her dying, already some 20 years ago now. She remained in a coma the whole time, more than a week, while Dad and all of us kids gathered around her and one another, sometimes in groups, sometimes all of us all at once, sometimes having turns by ourselves. When it was just me sitting at her bedside, holding her hand or brushing her hair, I'd sing that one to her. Over and over again, as she would do for me, especially on those nights as a child when I would just not go to sleep. And I'd mix in her favorite hymns, Beautiful Savior, Amazing Grace, Children of the Heavenly Father. Or I'd read to her, skipping here and there around her Bible, or maybe something from an out-of-date magazine I'd picked up in the waiting area down the hall. Or I would just sit with her quietly, watch the monitors, listen to the hospital sounds, the beeps and hisses and whirs of the machinery, the low murmurs of people talking elsewhere up and down the hall. Sometimes I'd get up and walk over to look out the window and marvel that other people were somehow still able to go on with normal life. That just didn't seem right somehow, that life goes on in the presence of death. Well, yes, okay, I guess that's the point, and very much as it should be. But still, geez, that's hard. I'd step away from the window, stretch my back, take a sip of water, by now having warmed to a thoroughly unsatisfying, neither here nor there, room temperature. Then sit back down and again take her soft hand in mine, sing a few times through, Naughty Little Bunny, and then back to the lullaby moon glow in that ancient forest with mossy linden cradle. And now and then, I'd just talk. I'd tell her, about our kids growing up so fast. Or about work, about 6 months into my then new job. Or about how things were coming on the house we were building. Decisions to make about the colors for this or that, or the hardware for this or that. Or about what it was like to be back in town with her, back in the hospital, Meeker County Memorial Hospital on South Sibley Avenue in Litchfield, Minnesota, recalling memories of times that I had been a patient there. Getting stitches out after a double hernia when I was 3 or so, languishing in a plastic oxygen tent with croup or whooping cough around that same age, maybe 4 or 5. Having my tonsils out the summer after kindergarten. My strongest memory from that one was that the nurses kept asking me if I wanted a popsicle. But because my anesthetic muddled brain thought they were asking me if I wanted a sucker, I kept saying, no, thinking to myself, I want something cold. Sure enough, I never did get a popsicle. I have had other hospital stays of my own over the years, including 2, one senior year of my high school and the other just 10 years ago now, that involved my nearly dying, painful and scary and clarifying of an even deeper fear of living an unlived life, or an even deeper still yearning that in whatever time is given to me, I live a life that matters. And my brushes with my own mortality, such as they've been, have also been reminders of the privileged life that I do have. Yes, I nearly died twice, but each time I was in a hospital, surrounded by wonders of technology and of human care. And how many people on the planet every day are dying and die without such gifts? We happen to be coming up on the 4th anniversary of the murder of George Floyd by police at the corner of 38th and Chicago, about a mile from where I now live in Minneapolis. I am white. George Floyd, of course, was black. His murder sparked a worldwide resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement. So, yes, I'm just going to say, black lives do matter. They matter whether white privilege says so or not. Black lives matter whether this particular white, heterosexual, married, middle-aged, able-bodied, well-educated, diabetic, English-speaking, progressive, Lutheran man says so or not. And at the same time, I think it's important, it matters for white men like me to say so. If only because we have for too long been the ones to claim with our words and our policies and legislation and behaviors and our guns and our economic and educational advantages that they don't. And it just doesn't help at all. In fact, I think it might make things worse for us white folks to make the claim that all lives matter, or that, referring to law enforcement, blue lives matter. That appeal to some kind of universal affirmation of human dignity, okay, sure enough, I'm not arguing against that per se, just misses the point. Precisely because black lives have been systemically and systematically discounted in ways that all lives, or blue lives, and certainly white lives, have not, the dignity and worth of black lives needs to be lifted up. On the one hand, race is a construct. It doesn't actually exist. On the other hand, skin color determines nearly everything. It matters. But it doesn't. Oh, but it does. When it comes to our physical bodies, I'm struck by the fact that matter is energy and space and relationships. And considering especially the skin our bodies are wrapped in, it may be that what matters is how we perceive and receive one another in all our radiant, flawed, broken and breakable, finite, mortal, miraculous wonder. We have bodies. Or better put, we are bodies. We are physical, embodied beings. Beings who desire, seek, acquire, pleasure in, are revolted by, lust after, and commodify matter, things, stuff, objects, territory, people. Some of it, food and water and air, we require in order to live at all. We grow it, harvest or gather it, package, ship, buy and sell it, display it, prepare it, ingest it, convert it to fuel, eliminate it, process it, dispose of it, waste it, starve for lack of it, or die from too much of it. According to the book Affluenza by John DeGraff, we spend more for trash bags in this country than 90 of the world's countries spend on everything. And in Douglas Adams' classic, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the extraterrestrial Ford prefect is nearly run over when he first arrived on Earth because, given how pervasive they were and how they seemed to shape the ecosystem to their needs, he assumed that cars were the dominant life form. From the sublime to the ridiculous. From the star stuff that we're made of, to the cow pies in the pasture in a warm summer rain, matter matters. But in many really important ways, we can choose how that is the case. What is our relationship to technology, for example? To our stuff? Where does our food come from? And why does that matter? It does, by the way. How do we treat the earth and its air and water and the creatures with whom we share the planet? How do we treat people? maybe especially those whom we perceive to be somehow different from ourselves, but whom we know, of course, are equally worthy and deserving of care and respect, no matter their skin color, or gender identity, or immigration status, or... And how are we showing up in our own embodied lives? How are you living with the fact of death? With the 100% certainty that everyone you've ever known and loved will die, that you will die. Life's limits, its finitude, is one of the things that makes it matter. And how are you living with the fact that life persists, that it goes on even and precisely in the presence of death, as it did those days when I watched from the hospital window as my mom lay dying? How are you living with the fact that your life, your embodied life, is that you are a wonder, a treasure, a rare and precious gift? How can I better nourish and nurture the life that I am for as long as I'm given, before I too am returned to the earth, to the pastures and the cow pies, and to the stars that birthed me? Gently rocked by every breeze. I'm Chris Johnson. Deeply grateful that you've listened to another episode of Pause, Purpose, Possibility, and that you are who you are in and for the world.